delighted to have all of our session leaders on stage at once, because I think we've had some really good, thought-provoking discussions. I've heard lots of good feedback from people who've enjoyed it today, which is great, so that's credit to you all, so thank you all. And I thought to begin, it would be nice to, I don't know how many of you got to sit in on each other's sessions. I know some of you are in here for all of them, some for some, but I thought it might be interesting to just get some reflections on some of the topics that you weren't involved in. I know there's some crossover during the panel discussions as well, but I thought it'd be interesting to hear your views on some of the key things that you felt came out of some of the discussions today. And maybe we could just ask Ben first.
Okay. Sure. So I think I'll try and perhaps comment on the kind of the sort of the variety or the need for variety. Certainly, like one of the themes that I think I've kind of detected from investors over the last few years as a result of the performance has been quite a kind of a bifurcation in sort of appetite going forward with respect to Nat Cat. There have been some investors who have basically, I think, have taken the position of, all I really want you to do as a manager is to understand Nat Cat as well as you can. And I'm not really interested in anything else at the moment until you can demonstrate to me, either as a manager or as an industry, that you really understand this as well as you can. If I think back to my days on the investor side during that kind of bull market run up to 16 and then ultimately 17, we spent a lot of time trying to, Nat Cat took care of itself, right? There were no dramas. 12 times a year, you got a NAV statement, and generally things were going up and to the right, so you're happy. So then you spent time saying, okay, well, what else can I be doing? Actually, this is actually quite boring. Well, boring's actually quite good, and boring's really what asset management's supposed to be about, in my mind. No surprises, the theme of the first session. So that's definitely kind of one cohort. And then I think there's another, and a former colleague of mine north of the Canadian border would probably kind of share this, which is actually my concerns about Nat Cat are so much that I want my bet to be somewhere else. So something a lot more varied.
Sure.
And I don't really see much in between. There tends to be those kind of that kind of bifurcation for me is something that's happening and something I think is really interesting at the moment.
Yeah, and that's possibly just a maturity stage of those ventures. I know the person over the border you've been talking about has been doing some very interesting transactions for a long time now and quite innovative. But it is still a very niche thing within the industry as a whole. But certainly I think the industry, by narrowing that gap between extremely niche and not commoditized, but much more popular and much more regularly issued, I think by bringing those two together, that's how you end up expanding the marketplace.
It's an interesting problem, though, because one of the things I've seen when trying to get cyber adopted is that, okay, Cat's been tough the past 5 years, but now it's paying a lot. Right, so if you're talking about like a second event, Florida 25, right online on that, I'm not going to give any sense of what I think it is, but it's chunky, right? And if you're looking at what would normally be considered an overpriced cyber buy by a buyer at high single, low double digit, what are you as an asset manager going to do? You're going to think, risk adjusted, this Florida deal probably is a lot riskier. A second event, Florida 25 is no joke. But I know what it is, and it's paying a fortune, rather than trying to convince a buyer to get close to double digits on a risk that I really don't understand anything about. But it's funny, during the boring times, it was hard to get anybody's attention on new assets because things were boring and going well, right? And then once things blew up in CAD over the past 5 years, you're so busy tending to your core business, claims analysis, tracking losses, raising capital, and then taking advantage of post-loss hardening, that it's hard to get your attention on other sectors as well. You're worse than I am when it comes to the camera.
Sorry, I'm looking at Tracy and Joe.
Oh, I thought you were going for the photographer, but that's my thing.
No,
sorry.
No.
And Judy, any thoughts from your point of view from what we've heard today?
From today. I think that my biggest takeaway is the level of engagement and the dialogue among the audience and the panelists. And I actually have to attribute that to my colleague, Ed Johnson, sitting back there. But it really is remarkable. I think that we're all pretty savvy. I know so many of these faces, and we've been doing this for so long. And I think that if we take what Ben had said about the past few years, I'm just sort of going to philosophize a little bit here, that, you know, I think certain players took advantage of the market and what was structured. And I think that that has come home to roost with some negative implications. And, you know, I don't want to say people were playing fast and loose in structures, but this sort of mantra we keep talking about all day that I hear from everyone as I reflect on the transparency and no surprises, as I said in my panel, investors do not mind taking losses. But what they don't want to do is have a loss that they didn't anticipate. They didn't think about how the deal was sold to them. So, you know, I think about today, I think that everyone's eyes are wide open, we're fully engaged, and because everyone's here, I think that everyone wants to make this market robust, and they want to bring this forward. I just think that maybe we need to collect, think about it, and just sort of a little bit go back to the drawing board. I mean, we have a lot of ideas, and I don't want to hog, but I think that that, to me, says a lot, that everybody has been so vocal in this audience, participating. You know, this is a market that has legs, and I think that we're going to see sort of that next evolution going forward.
Mm. And that transparency thread really went through the first two panels today, and then you have differentiation and casualty and longer tail lines and all of those things. And I guess, to me, it would seem very sensible that the industry approaches that differentiation from a first principles point of view of trying to solve for transparency issues and things like that first, because 5 years of Nat Cat with a tail emerging is one thing, but 5 years of longer tail line issues and losses, we could be talking about that at a conference 20 years later. So it seems even more important that right now some of the issues around transparency and things are worked on and solved within the industry, I would say.
The one thing I just want to point out about transparency, transparency is one thing, but I think that we need to be mindful that, and I've said this to, I think, most of the panelists here, is that a transaction, there are two sets of constituents. There's the issuer and there's the investor, and both are extremely vital to the success of a transaction. And I think that the investor side of the coin, now granted, I wear a sales hat, so I might be a little biased in looking at the investor side, but I think that the investor side has sort of, the past few years, hasn't been as much as a focus. And I think that as the broker-dealer, the banker standing in the middle, we have to recognize both set of constituencies, that a structure has to be as equally valid for the investor as it is for the issuer. So, and I think that that's where you get success. It's not a zero sum. A transaction isn't a zero sum game where one person should succeed at the expense of another. And I think that when I look back at some of these older transactions and just the way, I mean, we use the word transparency, but just certain structures, characteristics, I don't think lend itself to sort of that sort of equal nature of both sides of the party. But we're certainly going there, and I'm very hopeful, and some people said that I wasn't as positive as I usually am, but I am very positive for the future.
Good. Good to hear. Tom, any reflections from the other panels?
Well, yeah, basically, after Judy hearing you talk about transparency and your session on event definition, or your part of your session on event definition, as much as transparency, I'd like to see things that are correct. Beginning of the year, I had a number of people talking to me about political violence and terror ILWs, and we're talking about war exclusions within a terror ILW on my index. First off, how do you define war? And second, why are you excluding something that's not included in our index? So it makes my skin crawl to think that there are PCS global terror ILWs that have been done that include war in SRCC, because we don't report on them in that index, and somebody made the decision to enter into that trade without thinking about how the index actually works. So I think transparency is good. I think doing your homework is even better. And if you're looking at how an event is defined, you know, you've got to think within the context of the instrument, right? If it's a UNL product, I've got nothing to say except good luck. It's not my thing, right? But if you're doing industry loss index, you need to understand the index, you know, and asking the broker for the answer you want is not going to get you anywhere. That is the big takeaway, Stefan, I got from yours, is that we're worried about event definition, and I think that's healthy. I think there's a bigger discussion around just getting the basics right as an industry. I think Catthons, to your point, do a great job of that because so many sets of eyes are on them. But what happens in, you know, dark alleys, you know, there's a lot of scary stuff.
Stefan.
I'm not sure what to add, but I'll try it.
Your thoughts from the other
side. The theme of predictability of outcomes, I think, is probably, for me, the predominant theme. However, if you step back and you look back those 10, 12 years, we were an industry that was below 30 billion. 2011 was around. Today, we're an industry, it's close to 100 billion, right? So within a good 10 years, we've grown quite significantly. We do represent 15 to 20% of the global reinsurance market, which is quite an achievement in a little time frame, I'd say, when you look at it that way. Now, the last 5 years, and that's interesting, have been probably the worst years we've seen in a long time, and I think no one would disagree with that. Still, the capital in ILS has not shrunk tremendously. We still look at a close to 100 billion risk transfer capability. So that's a positive, isn't it, actually?
Absolutely.
Give me an example in the investment world where you have 5 years of poor results and still people don't run completely away, right? So that's an achievement itself. So it's a good base to build on. The question is now, where do we go from here? And what we've seen today, I think you have left, front, right, center possibility to expand. We're missing capacity in the cat bond space, big time. We have an issuance pipeline that's just amazing. Not so sure where we get all the capacity from, but we'll manage. So when you look at cyber, there's a huge need for risk transfer that's not fulfilled at all, let alone terror, political violence, and you have me. So when you start thinking in that sense, wow, this is promising, isn't it, actually? You add the layer of responsible investment, and I think we framed it today around ESG. I think we should not frame it around ESG because ESG is environmental, social, and governance. It's just the criteria we look at to measure sustainability and impact, right? I think the real theme is sustainability and impact. And that's another, I think, layer that we need to look at, which is very expandable. And we heard the US is, I'm not sure, lagging behind, but is a bit slower in the way it's adopting it and probably a bit differentiated in the way it's adopting it. In Europe, if I cannot prove a sustainable investment, my major investors will tell me we're going to walk away from you. Mm. As simple as that. And that's going to continue. So overall, I think we're looking at a very promising story. However, we have to fix the engine. And I think that's what we heard about a lot.
Sure. So you mentioned interesting there about sort of the opportunity. And I guess in order to capitalize on that opportunity, because clearly the industry is capable of producing products that the investor base want, new products that are responsible and sustainable and all of those good features. But have we got an origination issue in terms of actually getting people to buy those products? And are they products that we're going to sell to retro buyers and reinsurance buyers? Or does the ILS market need to be thinking a little bit further again, as it did a decade ago, about moving up the food chain and finding the buyers like Blackstone, for example, who are clearly interested in embedding risk capital as a sustainable element of their portfolios?
I can go first, sure. And again, oftentimes, and I feel we as an ILS industry, we're probably too much insurance, reinsurance minded and not enough investor minded, actually. And I think that's where you come from as well, right? To think how can we attract capital to help the industry grow should be the way, and not how we as an industry on the reinsurance side can lay off risk in the most efficient way to manage our balance sheets. I think this is probably the dilemma we're sitting in. So if we can bridge that and get the investor community and go back in history, the success of ILS was founded on a scenario after Hurricane Andrew when there was a capital crunch. And capital markets came in and helped to rebuild that industry, right? So probably we don't need to push it that far again, and probably start thinking a bit earlier about what can investors really do. I'm glad to hear my colleagues on the panel on that.
Anybody like to go on that?
Well, in terms of what we can do is, it's sort of thinking, I mean, as I think through all this, institutional capital can't be all things to all people. And I firmly believe, and yes, I wear a Swiss Re hat, that there is a place for reinsurance capital to sit side by side with this, you know, ILS capital, insurance, you know, however, you, you know, alternative capital space. And certain risks also need to be borne by the primary, you know, who, and there, this isn't the mortgage market where you have just originators who are passing along the risk. There isn't uniformity in how to think about that risk to allow that type of sort of value chain to occur where you just have somebody originating it and then you're just passing it off to them. There's too much, I don't want to say ambiguity, but different views on the risk, and we've just heard all day today about all risk policies. I think that for those peak perils, where there are capacity constraints, and we know that there are capacity constraints, that is where institutional capital can step in on a very plain vanilla, transparent basis to sort of complement what the reinsurers are doing. And I think that there's going to be more and more need for that as just in this sort of a hyperinflation world that we live in, that primary, there's going to be more need for more insurance and more need for reinsurance, and there's going to be then a correlate for more need for this type of capital. But I just don't think that we should think that this is a substitute for, or at least the bulk of what this is should be a substitute for reinsurance capital. Reinsurance has a balance sheet and it makes sense. So this concept of trapped collateral, that's why you have a balance sheet. You don't have, so if you're gonna put up a dollar of collateral, you're gonna invest a dollar, let's think about the structures that make sense when you're using a dollar for collateral. So it's just being mindful that institutional capital cannot be all things to all people, and you know, maybe there should be different silos. So I know that that sounds very vague, but...
Well, actually, it doesn't, and sitting between the two of you physically and between your remarks, it just makes perfect sense for the cyber market, right? You know, you've got ILS capital that could provide some amount of support. The cyber reinsurance market is looking at this saying, yeah, we're capital constrained, help us out. But, you know, the earlier part of your remark here, I was thinking, you know, who's retaining the risk and what type of balance sheet is it? You know, in cyber insurance companies are ceding 55% of what they write. You know, maybe it would be a lot easier to alleviate the capital crunch and provide reinsurance support and then find the appropriate entry point for investors if they actually held the risk instead of effectively acting as an MGA for the reinsurance industry. You know, until each link in the chain can get comfortable holding that risk and managing it, building a portfolio off of it, you're going to wind up with folks who want to keep sending it this way and investors who keep pushing back saying, you know, no, this is not the type of risk we want to consume. Yeah, you know, it's not about changing from your investor focus to your client focus at the expense of your investors, because a reinsurance buyer wants X, Y, and Z, and I want it to be a collateralized quota share, and I want it to be blue, and I want it to work under these conditions, because for an end investor, you can't make that work. It's just not sensible, right? So maybe if insurers and reinsurers found a way to get comfortable managing the risk more effectively, then they would find those limited use cases where ILS capacity would make more sense to, you know, pick up the stuff at the top of the tower, or, you know, take on the index triggered stuff that might have a shorter tail and more of a blunt instrument, but high enough up that a blunt instrument makes sense. You know, to me, sitting between the two of you, like, this is literally what just came to me. I mean, I think you both really bookend that cyber issue really clearly.
Well, out of curiosity, what do you think about cyber, Stefan, just from an investor perspective? So that is on everyone I know at Swiss Re, it's on our minds, not to put you on the hot seat.
Yeah, I would struggle today to find an investor base who would be willing to provide capital to cover cyber. Now, the way it's going to be packaged is important. The way it's understood, it's important. I think Schroders Capital has a huge private equity arm as well, actually. And I think the private equity side, they would step in for a cyber carrier or MGA big time. However, they would look at buying reinsurance so that the balance sheet's protected, right? So that tells you the story.
Oh, yeah.
So these are my colleagues with whom I'm working almost on a weekly basis. If I had to go to my investors and say, look, we're going to set up a fund that predominantly covers cyber risk or has a cyber allocation of 10, 15, 20% to diversify against natural catastrophe, I think they would tell me, no way.
And why would they say no way?
Because they currently do not believe the credibility of the models. They do not believe that we can validate historically the models, which is true. Whether they're right or not is a different story. We heard this morning, and I think CyberCube was very good in its presentation. But we don't have proof points that we master the risk with a predictable outcome.
Yeah, I kind of double down on those comments as well, certainly with the conversations that we've had with investors. That's kind of very much kind of resonates and rhymes with us. It's that idea of the bar is just higher. You know, this is a more esoteric risk. Again, to the earlier comments, we may have some concerns about how well you understand your bread and butter. So the bar is just higher. If this is going to come into a portfolio or be part of a standalone portfolio, you've got to go that extra step further. I was trying to pick at some themes from across some of the panels, and I think one that jumped out at me from a few of them was almost like, was the need for like a first mover advantage, is not the right thing to say, but sometimes you just need a product, right? Whether it's, you know, we talked about kind of micro insurance and things like that. You know, there's lots of examples in the sorts of things that products that the World Bank have brought to market, where once one does it, a lot will kind of follow. And I think something like cyber is like a classic example as well. You know, you need something. It's very easy for an investor to sit back and say, I've got concerns about this for A, B, and C reasons. Once you've got something that's kind of physical, it's you've got a test case, and I think it's easier to either get people over the line or not.
Mm. And cyber's very interesting because it's a risk that we've actually created ourselves as a society and humanity. We've built that code, we've built the infrastructure, we've left open the exploit holes, and we don't understand where we've left those, which makes, I think, people very, very nervous when they think about cyber. But I think Brittany did a great job of explaining that the models are really getting there. And maybe it is the perception of society and therefore the perception of investors that makes it a much more difficult thing to get to grips with, even though natural catastrophe risk is obviously completely out of your control and society's control.
Well, we'll see over the next 50 years. You know?
No, we haven't seen the major event as well that people expect.
No, I was referring to climate risk over the next 50 years. Some of that's going to be man-made, clearly.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's interesting what you say about sort of starting from the beginning with a product of some description as well, because that seems like an opportunity to perhaps put new practices in place around data and openness and transparency and all of those things that came up earlier today, is with some of the newer products that some startups are trying to create too. That does give the industry a chance to maybe start from a fresh point of view.
Yeah.
Just want to remind the audience that we can take questions at any point during this. I think I'm going to be the only person running around with a mic, which will be challenging, but I'm happy to come off the stage if needed. So just raise your hands whenever, because we'd really love to hear your points of view and what you thought of the sessions today, whether there's anything that resonated with you, anything that you didn't see was answered that you'd like to see answered now, because we've got four experts on the stage who can do that. But I also wanted this session to kind of try and end the day on a more positive note as well, because obviously we've talked about a lot of issues in the industry, and that's obviously been a theme of the last couple of years of virtual discussions as well. But I wanted to ask the panelists, sort of under the sort of with the backdrop of this event and what you've heard through today, and with thoughts around issues like climate change obviously is on everyone's mind. Litigation is still seen as a big issue, obviously, in certain areas of the world, and we've got a very big renewal coming up. Inflationary environment, geopolitical issues. There's lots of wild cards out there at the moment, and it feels like there's more of a probability of things becoming even more uncertain in terms of the results of some ILS structures. But what would you actually do? And Tom said, you mentioned positive change and that the industry should lead on things, which I think is really important as well. And it's something we've always tried to promote. So I'd be really interested to hear sort of, what are you solving for? What are you working on today without giving away your IP or anything like that? What are you solving for, or what do you want the industry to solve for? Looking forward, what's going to make this a more healthy and functional asset class? Not that it isn't today, but what's going to actually improve on things that we have today? Stefan, any thoughts? What are you solving for? What are your team solving?
All right. Let me put it in a bit of a wider context, actually. I think what we've seen in the investment world over the last few years is, well, equity markets have performed very well, but also private asset markets have performed very well. What we see is more and more, call it end investor or smaller investors, family offices, trying to come to what we call a private asset investment space, which is open for institutional investors, but often not open for smaller investors. We call that, to some extent, democratization. Democratization of assets that have not been accessible before, but they do offer either very good returns, like private equity, they offer inflation shielding, like ILS, they offer infrastructure investing because it's supporting a green economy that's transforming, and things like that, actually. So what we see as a group is a big shift in investment towards multi-asset private asset products, and we try to be part of that, actually. So to build ILS into a wider investment context that helps shaping portfolios that are also for intermediary investment channels suitable. So that's certainly one thing, and we feel that's a very interesting and developing area. Mm. Secondly, I think we're working on the theme that I moderated earlier. That's the, call it, new product. We try to channel investors also beyond cat risk into risk that's not been as explored by the ILS markets previously. One example is funds at Lloyd's. I should not probably make too much publicity for London Bridge, but it was in the press. But London Bridge is a good example where an old-fashioned London Lloyd's market tries to open up to bring capital into the underwriting part of its core, which means you may be able to access risk that has not been available in the same way previously. That's specialty risk, that's casualty risk, that can be property risk, but it's not cat risk, so it's decorrelated. When you look at Lloyd's a bit more closely, you can identify certain segments that have been profitable over a long period of time. And I think here to grow that is another opportunity for the market to expand beyond cat. So these are two examples we are working on, and we're trying to push forward, actually. So and that should be a positive for the industry.
No, I really like the first one as well, on the sort of the portfolio-based approach of bringing a basket of assets to large investors and making ILS a part of that from the core, rather than just selling ILS as a standalone product to them. It's more holistic with their own way of thinking about their investments, I think. Tom, I know you're always working on things. You've always got new products, and we always talk about them. But
yeah, so
what are you going to solve for us all?
Conceptually, not at a product level, but the problem we're looking at is the chasm between what insurers and reinsurers are writing and can't hedge up the chain, either to retro or ILS, right? So obviously, we've talked about cyber. I'm not going to beat that dead horse, but it's on the list, right? This year, we've seen a lot of specialty issues. So we've got a lot of insurance and reinsurance concentration, aviation, marine, onshore, offshore energy, political violence. You've got, I think we're going to be in what's our fourth consecutive year of multi-billion-dollar PV losses. So, I mean, that's a sign, guys, about the way the world is headed. And meanwhile, if you're a reinsurer and you fill your boots on PV or cyber or aviation, you cannot rely on a robust, readily accessible retro market in ILW or any other form. So there are people in the market who wrote robustly at 1-1, figuring they could turn around in January and lay it off on ILW basis, only to find that the best pricing they could get was either a reinsurer or an ILS funds, has a non-profane way to say this, like the price all right for anything, right? Yeah, I'll give you 20 online, I'll give you 18 online without understanding it. I don't like it, but that's enough to make me take it anyway. What we want to do is come up with the tools that help folks analyze those underlying risks, price them more effectively, and actually clear some trades. Now, the biggest barrier to this is the underlying rate environment, right? Undisciplined underwriting means that you are basically building an unhedgeable book, because if you can't hedge without invading your margins, you're stuck. So we can't solve for that. But what we can solve for are the tools and capabilities for the hedge, as long as you have the elbow room in your book to affect that hedge. And that spans a whole lot of classes of business that aren't heavily picked up in the ILS market, but are definitely ongoing business and societal risks: PV, cyber, ME, aviation. Separate from this, the other thing we're working on is an impact ILW, impact cap bond structure, where you would have a embedded carbon offset option to decarbonize the poor decisions that claimants make when they replace totaled assets after a cat. And we are oh so close to getting our first trade done. We've gotten to FOT, we're able to get past that, but I think we are right on the brink. And as soon as we can get an impact ILW done, we do hope it becomes the industry standard.
Interesting. Judy.
I guess I have a little different perspective. I just think that alternative capital cannot be all things to all people. And all these esoteric risks, I don't know, are necessarily meant to be in this market. And we have different types of goals. So we're talking about accessibility and scalability. So what I guess I would love for our market to think about, what are the priorities? Is the priority that there's this inflation and there's greater need for cat protection? So how do we create a product that we can scale to be billion, you know, we're at 100 billion. How do we create that to 200 billion? What should that product look like? How do we create a tradable product that there's full transparency for both sides and it's an easy, relatively easy process to securitize that cat? Like, I would, like, there's so many great minds, but everyone's off doing their own little thing, and they're these little, and it never becomes scalable, and everything is this little niche that then requires, because it's a little niche and it isn't scalable, it requires ginormous type of returns, like equity-like returns. And so that's fine as long as everyone's eyes are wide open for those sort of esoteric that you're basically asking, you're passing the buck. If you're an originator on these sort of more esoteric lines that you need to get paid, there's going to be real downside, so you need to get paid. There has to be real upside as well. And so as long as your eyes are wide open on all these other, I like to focus more on just how do we create a plain vanilla market that's really tradable. It's never going to be the mortgage market. I mean, for the most part, you know, the mortgage market is a financing tool. That's generally all investment. You're not really taking any risk when in the mortgage market. I mean, the below, you know, the junk mortgage is, you know, a fraction the size of the MBS market. But how do we make our market so that there aren't the surprises? And as I've said this a lot, I don't mean surprises don't equal losses. And I think that if we create this sort of product that's scalable, you will be able to bring more investors to the table. You'll be able to lower the price and have a much more robust market so that for, you know, the primary companies, there's more protection available to supplement what's available in the reinsurance market. But people, I guess I just am against originators, whether it's cyber or other types of risk, just trying to pass it off into the capital markets. You're getting paid, and you should demand, and whoever wants to buy that protection, you know, you have to be willing to pay up. Mm. And so that's almost like a private equity-like type of scenario returns. But that's not what, there's so many different markets here, but that's not what this tradable liquid market is in terms of the bond market. So I think we talk about a lot, we discuss a lot of different things. And from mine, this is not necessarily, at Swiss Re, we do try to do a lot. I mean, we've brought a lot of different types of perils beyond just natural catastrophe into the capital markets. But one of the hallmarks has always been of these other lines that we bring is, can we credibly sort of educate investors on the amount of risk they're taking? Because if you can't convince an investor about what that risk profile is, then they have no way to think about how to price it. So if you can't convince an investor on what that risk profile looks like, then it's really, it, you know, you can't transfer it into the capital markets, or at least in a 144A liquid format. So, you know, the problem is that there we've done mortality bonds, pandemic, and I think one of, and I think there's a real need for even more pandemic risk to be transferred into the capital markets. But one of the things that holds that market back from really exploding is that there's just a lot of different views on how to assess how much risk you're really taking in the bond. And until, that's the issue, until there's common understanding, and that's why Nat Cat works so well, is that, yes, AIR, RMS, you know, yes, everyone has, but generally speaking, you're all sort of in the same relative ballpark, and that's what allows you to be able to price and then trade it. So for all these other insurance lines, I think that maybe for now it's meant to be more equity-like returns, equity-like players. And then in our market of Nat Cat, which is certainly growing, there's inflation, so there's going to be more need. We need, and our pipeline, we were talking a little bit about the market's pipeline. The market, the pipeline is huge. And we're keeping our fingers crossed until, you know, summer that we, you know, move all this product out, which we're actually very hopeful. But prices are, you know, spreads are widening out considerably. And I think that what you're going to see for the fourth quarter is the combination of more plain vanilla structures that we're seeing, along with much wider spreads, is going to attract end investors to, you know, the Schroders of the world. But hopefully you'll be even more successful in this environment. And also remember, from a relative value perspective, the rest of the world, I mean, spreads are, you know, widening out. And so it's just, we can't be static. So yes, it might seem expensive now where, you know, things might be trading. Just think of what you had in the past as a gift. Things rise, you know, and so that's just the reality. But I'm extremely hopeful that the combination of that plain vanilla plus rising prices, you know, rising spreads, we'll see a lot more capital. So the fourth quarter, I'm very optimistic that we'll have even more capacity.
Sounds good.
I'll kind of pick on a thread towards the end of what Julie was saying, and apology in advance, this will probably be the most boring of the four answers you get. But in terms of what we're focused on at Hiscox ILS, a lot of it is just continuing to make sure that we're putting investors at the core of everything we do. You know, we're very mindful of the challenges of the last few years. We're very mindful that our investors consider the relationship as a partnership. You know, we were talking earlier this morning about transparency and trust. And it's kind of making sure for us that, you know, everything we can continue to do in terms of communicate our understanding of the risk that we're taking on their behalf is as good as can be. Working really hard on the levels of transparency. That's not the same as sending every number we've got to 10 decimal places to them, but it's sharing the information that we think allows our investors to make the correct assessment of the worthiness or otherwise of their investments with us. So that's kind of, I realize as the words come out of my mouth, that's a little bit boring, but again, that's kind of been my word of this panel. It's kind of, in a sense, it's kind of supposed to be what we're doing. So making sure that we're not only communicating about the risks we're taking at the moment on their behalf, but also, you know, being open. Somebody mentioned earlier that they felt there'd been a little bit of a theme through today of a degree of self-flagellation, and very few people do self-flagellation like Hiscox between just between these four walls. And please don't quote me on that. And, but there is a good side to self-flagellation, and that's that you do learn lessons. And I think that is an important thing in our communication with investors. Of course, nobody likes the surprises. Again, we've done this has been done to death over the last few years. But if you sit there and you're honest with an investor and say, okay, this was the way something went. It was a suboptimal outcome. This is what I've learned. This is how we're internalizing it. This is why we're doing things different. This is why your portfolios are better now. Then I think that's really at the kind of the core of the relationship. There's a really interesting kind of stepping off point, and I don't think it's for now, but I definitely think it's something to be considered. Maybe next year if you'll have me back, Steve. But around like the human side of things. Again, if you want to see another thread that's cut through today's, it's been, you know, you talked, Judy, you mentioned as the first thing you mentioned on this panel was, you know, the human aspect, the interactions. On the first panel this morning, Corey was sharing those challenges of, you know, bringing bonds to market in a world where it's all got to be done virtually. We've talked, you know, there are many people in the room that will be familiar with the kind of due diligence processes that investors need to go through with managers, which, you know, used to be a proper on-site, you know, does this place actually exist, you know, or is it just a PO box somewhere? And I think that's really, really core. And I don't want anybody to lose sight of that, because ultimately what we're doing to that transparency is the relationship between an investor and a manager is still very much kind of built on trust. And you can't quantify that. You can't put that in a model. You can't represent that in a number. And we're at Hiscox, that's what we're kind of really working on now, is that at least our investors feel that they can trust us to continue making the right decisions on their behalf. And to call back to the earlier comment about that sort of bifurcation of risk appetite going forward. So on the one hand, I guess what I've just described is trying to make sure the stuff that we do, our day-to-day, our bread and butter, is as good as it can be, which hopefully caters for the investors who are just asking. All we want you to do is go and take NatCat risk on our behalf. Don't get cute, don't get clever, try and keep it clean, no surprises, because ultimately what that's doing is that's forming 1 to 5% of a much larger portfolio. One of the things we didn't really talk about today, and maybe it's because the answer's obvious, is does the central tenet of an investment in ILS still stand? And I guess the fact that we've still got investors and we're still holding these conferences, it probably does. But I think it's an interesting channel, interesting thing to discuss. Does it still stand? Has it changed? Et cetera, et cetera. So for the investors who are looking for us to do as good a job as we can on that kind of the core, the peak perils, the NatCat, understand the secondary perils as well, that's great. But at the same time, sorry, this is a long-winded answer, but in answer to what are we thinking about, as an investment manager sort of joined at the hip with a sort of 100-year-old plus insurance and reinsurance company that does a lot more than just P&C, we're continuing to look at the specialty space as well, because for that second type of investor, which is just want to go and do something that is different, now we're trying to spend the time finding out and demonstrating if we understand these risks and to what extent we can then package them up in a way that's capitally efficient and makes sense for it. And ultimately is solving an investment challenge for an investor. That's why we're an investment solution. Right? That's what we're providing.
That's very interesting, because I have correlation written down here with a question mark, and is this the right sales pitch anymore from a session earlier today? So prescient there, Ben. Any questions in the audience at all? Anybody have any points? Because now it's now or never, really. You've got about 5 minutes or so before we're going to break for drinks, and it's a good chance to get a last question or two. Somebody must have.
You got a couple over here, Steve.
Ah, brilliant. There we go. I was going to say, I can start picking on people otherwise.
Hi, Henri Minon from Akinova. In 20 seconds, each of you, if you could dream up what an industry that would be about five times the size of what it is today, what would you see as being the key points to getting there?
I think, I can give it a start, actually. I'm five times our size, we would be at 500 billion, which means we would almost match the size of the entire reinsurance that's existing today, actually, which is interesting, right? Which means if we project the reinsurance industry at the same scale, we'd be probably around
2.5 trillion as an overall industry capacity. So imagine, it's a great question, what do we cover? All the risks out there, which means we need to quantify the risk, we need to trade the risk, we need platforms to do so. So I think it's about quantification of risk, which kind of risk will be transferred, and what technology we're going to use. And it's exactly what you, Judith, I think, said earlier. Is that a feasible scenario right now? Not sure. In a few years from now, that would be great because it will fill protection gaps. We have a massive different risk transfer industry, which is a way more resilient, be it climate change or other things, actually.
So five times its current size, I think, protection gap, maturing microinsurance to the point where it's full-sized insurance, probably a bit of the bigger problems that are out there. That means figuring out PV, figuring out flood. And I don't think any of this happens without a more effective approach to distribution, which remains the single biggest problem in every point in the chain, insurance, reinsurance, ILS. So basically, we need to get better at describing our product and helping people realize that they can apply it to their own problems.
And I hate to say this because I'm going to probably sort of, I think that it has to become more mainstream. If you really want this to be $500 billion, we need Morgan Stanley, BAML, you can't have Fidelity, Wellington, like the huge money managers are not going to be trading with us. It has to become and I'm not trying to denigrate, you know, Swiss Re and Aon and GC, but if this is to be that size, then the investment banks have to get in. And why are the investment banks not in it? Because it pays nothing. There's no incentive. Unfortunately, that's the truth. The underwriting fees we make, I almost feel like we do this out of the goodness of our heart at Swiss Re, and our trading, it's to facilitate the market. We get paid nothing. So, and I hate to be so blunt about this, but if this is very important to the cedents, if issuers see value in buying this protection, then they should actually put value to that and pay up. And I think that if there is, and so that's a theme. So not only paying more for the protection, but paying the intermediaries who are going to source that capacity for you, there should be some value to that. And I think that if there's sort of a new paradigm in terms of sort of underwriting fees and the spreads, investment banks are greedy. So if that exists, they will come in and they will participate and they will dedicate traders. They will then make markets. So it won't be this backwater, weird asset class. And so we've tried everything at Swiss Re to make this look like an on the run. We were the first who created indices because we knew that managers needed to benchmark their performance. And I remember going back to Lehman Brothers and asking them to include cat bonds in their indices, and they laughed at us. So that's why, you know, then we got approval to publish our own indices. You need traders, and there needs to be more liquidity. You need to have some market makers. Right now, liquidity is sort of a one-way street, but as the market gets bigger and bigger, you will see real liquidity. So I think that those are some of the hallmarks of a robust, functioning market. So to the cedents, and not Joe, Tracy, you guys don't have to pay more, but generally speaking, just to be honest, it doesn't pay that well, and so you're not going to get you're not going to get those type of intermediaries involved. So that's so to me, truly, if you want it that size, then there has to be a true mind shift. Sorry.
I'll be.
Not that Swiss Re will be there, but yeah, we need everybody. I mean, I think that you need all the banks to be involved.
I suspect I've ceded my 20 seconds to my colleagues, but I would say I think from a macro level, I would agree with everything they said. I mean, like to be slightly flippant and actually call back to a comment Matt Burdoff made in the first. He's looking up now, Matt. A comment that you made in the first panel, which is no losses, and I don't mean to be flippant about that as well, but ultimately who's the sorts of people who are going to be the current investors currently in ILS who are providing capital, and we'd like them to provide more, need to not be given a reason to
disappear. And there are a lot of investors at the moment that won't stomach any more surprises.
Did we have another question? Nope. Okay. Okay, I think, I know that says, but we're actually over time anyway. That's running a bit behind. So I think we're going to wrap things up then. I'd like to say an enormous thank you to the four session leaders. Can we please give them all a round of applause because they've done a great job.